Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part one of a fine talk by historian Howard Zinn. It's on war, social justice, and the power of the people. I hope you'll stay tuned. Howard Zinn was a very good historian, for many years a professor at Boston University. His politics were left of center, but they never fit clearly into any one ideology. Zinn did insist the one thing he definitely was not was a liberal. Right on. He is best known for his very popular book, A People's History of the United States, published in 2007. Zinn writes in a simple, clear, plain style. The real interest in his writing is the content. As a historian, he focuses on the lives of normal people, not the elites. The constant struggle of normal people for economic and social justice. His writing also shows the people constantly organizing to fight back against the system, and sometimes winning. Exciting stuff, stuff they would never teach you in school. Alas, Zinn died in 2010. Today, we will hear part one of a talk Zinn gave late in his life, part one of three parts total. He spoke in Binghamton, New York, on November 8, 2008. That's 3 days after Barack Obama was elected to be president. Zinn had supported Obama, but Zinn is disturbed by Obama's militarism, his indifference to social justice, and his subservience to Wall Street at the expense of the people. In any case, for Zinn, real social change always comes from the people organizing themselves and compelling change, not from politicians or political parties. Zinn's talk is titled, The Power to Change. Here is part one.
Thank you. Thank you. Since I'm here, I may as well speak. May even speak on the topic that I'm supposed to speak about, which is war and social justice. Did you know that's what I'm going to speak about? Well, it doesn't matter. That's what I'm going to speak about whether you like it or not. Okay? I don't know if you noticed it in the recent presidential campaign. War was not number one on the agenda of the presidential candidates. Did you notice that? It wasn't. It was there in the background. Oh, yeah, there's a little war going on. Oh, yeah, there are two wars going on. But we'll talk about something else. We'll talk about economic issues. We'll talk about, well, remember, that's what the candidates talked about, right? They talked about health and the reform, and they talked about taxation, and you know, they talk about economic troubles and things like that, you know? And somehow, you know, the war was missing in a campaign. And the question is, you know, why? And I think one reason is that it's easier to talk about issues of social justice, especially if what you talk about is not really concrete. If things are complicated and ambiguous, if both candidates present health plans which the average person cannot really easily distinguish one from the other, so easier to do that, easier to talk about that. But I want to talk about social justice, and I want to talk about war, and I want to talk about the connection between the two. And my starting point for talking about social justice is to ask, well, you know, what really would constitute social justice, or what would constitute a real agenda for social justice? And this is not something that the candidates used as their criteria. I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You may know that this year is 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. The Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1948, a few years after the end of World War II. Eleanor Roosevelt was very, very important in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And if you get a chance, take a look at it. It's not hard to find it, right? Google. Google is the answer to everything. Yeah, Google the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You'll see the many, many parts of it. But fundamentally, what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, and well, you go right to number 25, right? And it'll say that everybody on the planet has a right to housing, health, food, health care, education. Everybody on the planet has an equal right to all of those things. Well, that's a tall order. In order to achieve that, you'd have to go a long way from where we are. And you'd have to suggest a lot more bolder programs than were suggested by either of the two candidates. I know you may be wondered why I keep talking about the two candidates almost as if they were both doing the same thing. They weren't exactly doing the same thing, no. And Obama was saying more and better than McCain. And well, there are many reasons why Obama was preferable to McCain. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. But I think both of them fell short, as far as I was concerned, of what they should be doing. But you see, I'm not a politician, right? And it's not the job of the citizen to be a politician. The politician may think that he must moderate and must be careful and must stop short here and stop short there. The citizen should not be doing that. The citizen should not confuse himself, herself, about being a citizen or a politician. The citizen should speak out fully, boldly, clearly on exactly what the citizen thinks is the truth. And then if the candidate is a politician, you know, wants to play with that because it's politically useful, okay, that's their problem. But we, as citizens, have to simply speak our minds. We mustn't be deflected from what we consider to be the truth by the sort of political opportunism and of candidates, what they perceive is a politically necessary thing to do. So, yes, I think our test for social justice should be the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everybody entitled to total health care, free education, food, housing, everybody. You see. Oh, by the way, just as a little aside on social justice, I think I will sort of anticipate what might be a question in the question period and get it out of the way now so I don't have to deal with it later. I anticipate that at some point in the question period, somebody will say to me, well, but what do we do? It always comes up. Why? Because the speaker is speaking in grandiose terms. I always speak in grandiose terms. The speaker speaking, you know, about larger things. The speaker speaking about the world and the nation and war and peace and all of these really important issues. But the person sitting in the audience saying, okay, enough. But what shall I do? You know, what can I do? So I'm anticipating that question and trying to deal with it now. Because my answer is usually look around you. Look around you at the community. Look around you in the university. Look around you wherever you are. See what's going on. See who's having a problem. Is there an immigrant having a problem? Is there a person having a problem with the police? You know, is there an environmental issue that's come up because some industry has polluted the environment? Look around you. Is somebody being fired unnecessarily? Is somebody being paid lower than minimum wages? Or maybe they're just being paid minimum wages, which are bad enough, right? So that's the kind of thing. And then as I was coming here, or as I was talking to people before coming here, they said, well, you know what's happening on campus, that the food workers are having trouble. Did you know that? The food workers are having trouble with getting their contract renewed because they want to get more than $6 or $7 or $8 an hour. They can't take care of a family on that. Well, there's an issue for you right here. You don't have to go far. You don't have to, you know, right? We all should be helping people around us who need help. It's called solidarity. That's what solidarity is. Yeah. You know, why is all the political rhetoric limited? Why is the set of solutions given to social and economic issues so cramped and so short of what is needed, so short of what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights demands? And Obama, who obviously is more attuned to the needs of people than his opponent. Obama, who is more far-sighted, more thoughtful, more imaginative, why has he been limited in what he is saying? Why hasn't he come out for what is called the single-payer system in health care? You all know what the single-payer system is. It's a sort of awkward term for it, maybe. It doesn't explain what it means, but a single-payer health system means, well, it'll be sort of run like Social Security. It'll be a government system. It won't depend on intermediaries, on middle people, on insurance companies. You won't have to fill out forms and pay, and figure out whether you have a pre-existing medical condition. You won't have to go through that rigmarole which has kept 40 million people out of having health insurance. No. Something happens, you just go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, you're taken care of. Period. The government will pay for it. Yeah, the government will pay for it. That's what governments are for. Governments, that they do that for the military. Do you know that? That's what the military has. The military has free insurance. I was once in the military. I got pneumonia, which is easier to get in the military. I got pneumonia. I didn't have to fool around with deciding what health plan I'm in or what, No, I was totally taken care of. I didn't have to think about money. There's a million members of the armed forces who have that. But when you ask that the government do this for everybody else, they cry, that's socialism. Well, if that's socialism, it must mean socialism is good. Right? I was really gratified when Obama called for let's tax the rich more and let's tax the poor and middle class less. And I said, that's socialism. And I thought, whoa, I'm happy to hear that. Finally, socialism is getting a good name. You know, socialism has been given bad names, Stalin and all those socialists, so-called socialists. They weren't really socialists, but, they called themselves socialists, but they weren't really, you see. And so socialism got a bad name. It used to have a really good name. Here in the United States, the beginning of the 20th century, before there was a Soviet Union to spoil it, you see, socialism had a good name. Millions of people in the United States read socialist newspapers. They elected socialist members of Congress and socialist members of state legislatures. There were like 14 socialist chapters in Oklahoma. Really? I mean, socialism. Who stood for socialism? Eugene Debs, Helen Keller, Emma Goldman, Clarence Darrow, Jack London, Upton Sinclair. Yeah, socialism had a good name. It needs to be restored. And so... But Obama, with all of his goodwill, intelligence, all those qualities that he has, and so on, you feel that he has a certain instinct for people in trouble, but still, you know, he wouldn't come out for a single-payer health system. That is for what I would call health security, to go along with social security, you see. Wouldn't come out for that. Wouldn't come out for the government creating jobs for millions of people, because that's what really is needed now. You see, when people are, the newspapers this morning report highest unemployment in decades, right? The government needs to create jobs. Private enterprise is not going to create jobs. Private enterprise fails. The so-called free market system fails again and again. When the Depression hit in the 1930s, Roosevelt and the New Deal created jobs for millions of people. There were people on the, out there on the fringe who yelled, socialism. Didn't matter. People needed it. If people need something badly and somebody does something for them, you can throw all the names you want at them. It won't matter. You see? But that was needed in this campaign. Yes. Instead of Obama and McCain joining together, I know some of you are maybe annoyed that I'm being critical of Obama, but that's my job. That's a citizen, I like him, I'm for him, I want him to do well, I'm happy he won, I'm delighted he won, but I'm a citizen. I have to speak my mind, okay? Yeah. And, But when I saw Obama and McCain sort of both together supporting the $700 billion bailout, I thought, uh-oh. No, please don't do that. Please, Obama, step aside from that. Do what... I'm sure something in your instincts must tell you that there's something wrong with giving $700 billion to the same financial institutions which ruined us. We got us into this mess. Something wrong with that, you see. And it's not even politically viable. That is, you can't even say, oh, I'm doing it because people will then vote for me. No. It was very obvious when the $700 billion bailout was announced that the majority of people in the country were opposed to it. Instinctively, they said, something is wrong with this. Why give it to them? We need it. That's what the government, Obama should have been saying. No, let's take that $700 billion. Let's give it to people who can't pay their mortgages. Let's create jobs, instead of pouring $700 billion into the top, and hoping that it will trickle down to the bottom. No, go right to the bottom where people need it. So, yes, that was a disappointment. I'm trying to indicate what we'll have to do now to fulfill what Obama himself has promised, change, real change. You can say change, but if you keep doing the old policies, it's not change, right? So what stands in the way of Obama and the Democratic Party and what stands in the way of them really going all out for a social and economic program that will fulfill the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Well, I can think of two things that stand in the way. Maybe there are more, but I can only think of two things at a time. Well, one of them is simply the great powerful economic interests that don't want real economic change. Really, they don't. They're powerful. I mean, you take in health care. There are powerful interests involved in the present health care system. People are making lots of money from the health care system as it is, making so much money, and that's why the costs of the health care system in the United States are double what the health care costs are. The percentage, you know, of money devoted to health care percentage is double administrative costs in the United States compared to countries that have the single-payer system, because there are people there who is siphoning off this money, who are making money. You know, their health plans, their insurance companies, their health executives and CEOs, so that there are, yeah, there are interests, economic interests that are in the way of real economic change. And Obama so far has not challenged those economic interests. Roosevelt did challenge those economic interests boldly, right frontally. He called them economic royalists. He wasn't worried that people would say, "Oh, you're appealing to class conflict," you know, the kind of thing they pull out all the time, as if there isn't, hasn't always been class conflict. It's something new, you know, class conflict. You're creating class conflict. We've never had class conflict. We've always all been one happy family, you know. No, so yeah, there are these interests standing, you know, in the way, and you know, unfortunately, the Democratic Party is tied to many of those interests. Democratic Party is tied to a lot of corporate interests. I mean, you look at the people who are on Obama's economics team, and they're, you know, they're Goldman Sachs people, and they're former, you know, people like that, you know. That's not, they don't represent change. They represent the old style democratic, stay put leadership. It's not good. So, the other factor that stands in the way of a real, bold economic and social program is the war. The war. The thing that haven't, you know, a $600 billion military budget. Now, how can you call for the government to take over the healthcare system? How can you call for the government to give jobs to millions of people? How can you do all that? How can you offer free education, free higher education, which is what we should have, really? We should have free higher education. Well, how can you, you know, how can you double teacher salaries? And how can you do all these things which will do away with poverty in the United States? It all costs money. Where's that money going to come from? Well, it can come from two sources. One is the tax structure. And here Obama been moving in the right direction. When he talked about not giving the rich tax breaks and giving tax breaks to the poor, in the right direction, but not far enough. Because the top 1% of the richest 1% of the country has gained several trillions of dollars in the last 20, 30 years as a result of the tax system, which has favored them. And, you know, you have a tax system where 200 of the richest corporations pay no taxes. You know that? You can't do that. You don't have their accountants. You don't have their legal teams and so on and so forth. You don't have their loopholes. The war, $600 billion. We need that. We need that money. But in order to say that, in order to say, well, one, we're going to increase taxes on the super rich much more than Obama has proposed. And believe me, it won't make those people poor. They'll still be rich. They just won't be super rich. I don't care if there's some rich people around. But, you know, no, we don't need super rich, not when that money is needed to take care of little kids in preschool, and there's no money for preschool. No, we need a radical change in the tax structure, which will immediately free huge amounts of money to do the things that need to be done, and then we have to get money from the military budget. Well, how do you get money from the military budget? Don't we need $600 billion for the military budget? And don't we have to fight two wars? No. We don't have to fight any wars. You know, and this is where Obama and the Democratic Party have been hesitant, you know, to talk about. But we're not hesitant to talk about it. The citizens should not be hesitant to talk about it. If the citizens are hesitant to talk about it, they will just reinforce the Democratic leadership and Obama in their hesitations. No, we have to speak what we believe is the truth. And I think the truth is we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. I mean, these wars are absurd. They're horrible. Also, they're horrible and they're absurd.
And here we must pause Howard Zinn's long and fascinating talk, The Power to Change. More to come in the next 2 weeks on New World Notes. For the original recording, thanks to Lynn Gurry and the Unwelcome Guests Collective, unwelcomeguests.net. We too have a website with a free archive of our shows, and that address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again for more of Howard Zinn next week. Peace.